You're with AFP Audio, and I'm speaking to Kiernan Hughes, who's the author of Goiter, Causes, Investigation and Management, in the latest issue of AFP on thyroid disease. Welcome, Kiernan.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Dr. Kiernan Hughes is an endocrinologist at the Sydney Thyroid Clinic in New South Wales. So your article on goiter starts with the causes of goiter. Could you outline some of the common causes of goiter?
Yeah, well, the causes of goiter really depend on where you are in the world, and the reason for that relates to the prevalence of iodine deficiency. So in Australia, where iodine deficiency is usually only mild, iodine is no longer the main cause of goiter, whereas in other areas of the world it still remains the dominant cause. In Australia, we see more commonly people with autoimmune disease, so Hashimoto's or Graves, and also people, of course, with thyroid nodules, whether or not they be a single nodule or multiple nodules. So those are the main three categories of causes of goiter.
And iodine deficiency, while not severe in Australia, does exist?
It does, yeah. So there was a good national survey done just several years ago revealing that on average Australians are mildly iodine deficient. So it has re-emerged as an issue. Back in the 1960s and 70s, the dairy industry were using iodinated materials in order to sterilise their milking equipment, and that meant we were all getting a little bit of iodine in milk. But they've changed the technology they use for that, which has meant that the average Australian did become mildly iodine deficient. Because of that, in 2009, it was legislated that bread makers would be forced to add iodine to bread. So now if you really all forms of bread, apart from obviously homemade bread, or the other exemption is for organic bread, but all other forms of bread will now have iodine included in them. And this is estimated to get the majority of Australians up to an adequate level of iodine intake without causing an unacceptably high risk of excess iodine intake. So most Australians are now iodine sufficient, and those that are deficient tend to only be mildly so. The one exception to this is in pregnancy, where our iodine requirements do increase a lot, so it's certainly now a recommendation for all pregnant women to take an iodine supplement in order to meet the recommended daily intake of iodine in pregnancy.
And that's a supplement of 150 micrograms a day?
Yeah, that's right. So the target is really for an intake of 250 micrograms, so taking a supplement of 150 gets the pregnant women up to that.
Yep.
It depends on the formulation that you use. The most popular ones in Australia would be Elevit, which provides 150, or iFolic. Blackmore's, which is also common, provides 75. So Blackmore's Gold, you'd need to take two of them.
Yep.
So it's important they just look on the side of the packet of whatever supplement they're using. But most of the main manufacturers have now agreed to put the iodine into those standard pregnancy supplements.
Yep. So back to the patient with goiter. Obviously, they can present with a mass in the neck, but there are some other possible symptoms they can present with, you mentioned in the article.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting, I guess, in modern medicine, when we're doing tests for a lot of things, it's becoming very common for people to present with goiter without symptoms. In other words, it's being picked up when a scan's being done for another reason. So commonly, if someone has a chest x-ray or a CT scan, then the radiologist might comment on the presence of a goiter, and many of those people are asymptomatic. Some are also detected just on routine clinical examination, so with their general practitioner, who might notice a lump in the neck that the patient's quite unaware of. So I'd say those are the two most common category. Outside of that, of course, once the goiter gets to a certain size, it will cause symptoms by virtue of its location in the neck, wrapped around both the windpipe and then posterior to that the esophagus. So common symptoms are a feeling of pressure in the neck, difficulty with swallowing, cough or a tickle in the throat is very commonly reported. And with larger lesions, there can be voice changes related to pressure on the recurrent laryngeal nerve. So a hoarse voice is something that's often picked up.
And if a patient presents in any of those ways, what examination would you recommend GPs do?
Well, the nice thing about the thyroid is that it does sit right at the front of the neck, and therefore it is fairly easy to feel. Having said that, it varies in its location in terms of how high in the neck it is, so sometimes it can be lower down, which makes it more difficult to feel. So obviously, in the first instance, a good thorough examination of the neck, feeling for the thyroid and trying to identify the consistency, the size of the thyroid, and the presence of any nodules. Having the patient swallow during the examination is very useful because you'll feel the thyroid rise beneath your fingers, and it also lets you palpate the inferior margin of the thyroid if the thyroid is more low-lying in the neck. Having said that it is fairly easy because of its position, it is challenging, and it's certainly a examination that requires a fair bit of experience to do well. And for that reason, many people, if we suspect a goiter to be present, then an ultrasound will be appropriate to further evaluate that.
You suggest it's almost like an extension of the physical examination these days.
Yeah, I think certainly in specialist endocrine practice, we have access to ultrasound machine at the time of our examination, and even though I spend most days feeling thyroids, I'm still often surprised about the size of nodules that can be present that aren't palpable, and ultrasound has really taught us that, and the accuracy of ultrasound really is far in excess of physical examination. So while examination remains an important first step, I think if we're suspicious, then we should have a low threshold for arranging ultrasound, which is really a fairly low cost and low morbidity investigation with really no risk of harm.
And you also mentioned just checking for obstruction of the thoracic inlet.
Yeah, so with patients with larger lesions, larger thyroids in particular, you can get symptoms related to thoracic inlet compression. So if we get them to raise their arms above their head, really you've got to get the arms right up next to their ears, and this draws the thyroid down into the thoracic inlet that can cause obstruction and therefore flushing. So this is known as Pemberton's sign, and you'll notice flushing in the face, and some patients really find it quite uncomfortable and can even get a little bit out of breath with it. But I'd say that this sign is only positive in people with fairly significant goiters. It would be unusual to see this with only, you know, small thyroids or small nodules.
So obviously ultrasounds are a pretty important test. Are there any laboratory investigations you'd do in the first instance?
Yeah, so I think if you're suspecting a goiter, then a TSH is the single best blood test to do, because it's the most accurate way of assessing thyroid function, and that will help guide subsequent investigation. So if you feel that thyroid's enlarged or you can feel a nodule, then firstly we really should be checking a TSH, and if the TSH is low, suggesting an overactive thyroid, then it would be appropriate to do a nuclear scan to assess thyroid function. And in fact, that's often a more useful test than the ultrasound in that setting. Obviously, if the TSH is deranged, then it's also useful to then assess free T4 and free T3 to get a better idea of the overall thyroid status and the degree of under or overactivity, and also thyroid antibodies. So in the setting of a low TSH, so an overactive thyroid, I would repeat the test along with the free T4 and free T3 and also request thyroid antibodies. This is one area where currently, if you just simply request thyroid antibodies, the labs will do an anti-TPO and an anti-TG antibody, but they won't do a thyroid receptor antibody. So if clinically you're suspecting Graves, which is the most common cause of thyrotoxicosis in Australia, then a thyroid receptor antibody level is often a useful extra test to request that can confirm that clinical suspicion.
If the TSH is elevated, you'd obviously want to check the antibodies as well for...
Yeah, so if the TSH is elevated, then the routine thyroid antibodies are useful, but in that setting you don't need that specific thyroid receptor antibody, because while Graves can cause an underactive thyroid, it's far more common to cause hyperthyroidism, whereas the other two antibodies are often present both in over- or underactive thyroids.
So in a patient who might be thyrotoxic on bloods, and perhaps an ultrasound was done and they had a nodule, a nuclear medicine scan would probably be the next step you were mentioning.
Yeah.
And if it showed a hot nodule, what are the possible causes of that and treatments for that?
Yeah. So this is a fairly common situation. So a patient with thyrotoxicosis, usually of the more mild thyrotoxicosis, and you see a nodule on ultrasound, they go on to have a thyroid uptake scan. The thyroid uptake scan is important because while the ultrasound gives you very good anatomical detail of the thyroid, it doesn't give you good information as to the function of that thyroid. And this is where the thyroid uptake scan is very useful. So a hot nodule is hot simply because that part of the thyroid is working hard and therefore it's taking up more of the isotope. In the setting of thyrotoxicosis from a hot nodule or so-called toxic adenoma, then you expect that nodule to be hot, but also importantly the remainder of the gland to be relatively suppressed because the patient's thyrotoxic, the TSH is low, so the normal parts of the thyroid effectively get put to sleep. So you just get this one toxic nodule producing too much thyroid hormone and the remainder of the gland is suppressed. The treatment of choice for most people in that situation will be therapeutic radioiodine, known as I-131. And the reason for that is that it often is a definitive single-dose treatment, and it usually achieves cure with a fairly low risk of hypothyroidism because the remainder of the thyroid gland is suppressed. Therefore, the radioiodine tends to only be taken up by the toxic nodule. Alternative treatments would be thionamide medication, but the downside of that in this setting is that because you're simply blocking thyroid hormone production, you're not really addressing the underlying problem, and so you know you're effectively committing the patient to indefinite treatment with thionamide medication. And while these drugs are generally safe, they do have potential side effects and also potential serious adverse effects. So we generally prefer a once and for all treatment with radioiodine rather than thionamide medication in the setting of a toxic nodule. I guess it would be remiss of me to say that surgery would also be a choice for these patients, but it's not one that would be a commonly made decision unless the nodule was very large and causing a lot of compressive symptoms because of the risks associated with surgery and I guess also the cost.
Other than thyrotoxicosis, the other risk with the nodule is that it might be cancerous. So perhaps in a patient who had a normal thyroid function on bloods and a discrete nodule, one or more discrete nodules was found on ultrasound, what's the pathway to finding out whether it's cancer?
Yeah. So the start of the pathway is the same in the sense that we first check thyroid function, and then if the thyroid function is normal, which it usually is in the setting of malignancy, or if anything, the TSH tends to be high, then the next test depends a little bit on the ultrasound features. So certainly ultrasound to characterize the lesion. Now, the decision-making about who should have a biopsy has become fairly complex. The American Thyroid Association has produced some very useful guidelines on who needs a biopsy and who doesn't. Simplistically, most patients with a nodule that's greater than 1 centimeter should be at least considered for a biopsy. The latest guidelines make it slightly more complicated by virtue of they say that it depends a little bit on the ultrasound characteristics as to what our size threshold should be. So if someone has a very high risk history, so in other words they had radiotherapy in childhood or a family history of thyroid cancer, then we might consider biopsying nodules as small as 5 millimeters. Whereas if that history isn't present, then most solid nodules we wouldn't biopsy until they're greater than 1 centimeter. There are other nodules which are lower risk, and therefore the size threshold increases. So if you have a nodule that is purely cystic, so a black nodule with really no solid component, then these are almost never malignancies and therefore usually don't require a biopsy. The other category are the so-called spongiform nodules, which are they're called that because they look a bit like a sponge, so they've got black cystic areas within a solid nodule. These type of nodules, most people don't biopsy them until they reach about the 1.5 to 2 centimeter threshold. So it has become slightly more complicated, but I think still, if we remember the general principle of once it's bigger than 1 centimeter, we should be thinking about a biopsy, but the individual decision should be based on the patient characteristics and also on the ultrasound features.
The ultrasound features, if a GP orders a regular thyroid ultrasound from a regular lab, local lab,
yeah,
they're likely to get the features that are necessary for that kind of...
Yeah. Obviously, there isn't standardized reporting, unfortunately, of ultrasound, and therefore the quality is quite variable. One of the temptations of radiology practices is simply to make a comment like, I would be happy to biopsy this if desired, without making any comment about whether or not a biopsy is necessary or appropriate. So in other words, the radiology practice is pushing that decision back onto the GPs. A good lab should be reporting on some of the features. So the main ones would be talking about whether or not it is a, if you see it, the description purely cystic, then that is a setting where you could reasonably leave it alone. The ultrasound features that increase the risk of malignancy are a hypoechoic nodule, so hypo as in the nodule is darker than the surrounding thyroid. Although most of these lesions will still not be malignancy, it does slightly increase the risk of malignancy. Other features are if the nodule has increased vascularity, so particularly central vascularity, that's associated with malignancy because malignant tumours require more blood flow in order to maintain their rate of growth. Conversely, a peripheral pattern of vascularity is more benign, so where the blood vessels are mainly being pushed around to the periphery of the nodule by a very slow-growing nodule. Other features to make you have a lower threshold would be microcalcification. So I think if the radiologist comments on a lesion that is greater than 1 centimetre, I generally encourage it to be biopsied. And if they comment on features of hypoechoic microcalcification or increased vascularity, that would be the other features to make you have a lower threshold for arranging a biopsy.
I guess a call to your friendly endocrinologist.
Yeah, well, certainly we're always available. Well, not always, but we try to make ourselves available.
And if a lesion has, if you do a fine needle aspirate and it is negative, or it's definitely benign, would that lesion need to be followed up at all?
Yeah, so again, this is an area of quite divergence, rather large divergence in practice. The latest guidelines would recommend that a nodule that was subjected to biopsy that came back as clearly benign should be reassessed, usually with ultrasound, in 6 to 18 months to assess whether or not it's growing. The reason for this is obviously that the biopsies are a fairly small, a very small needle, and there is the potential for sampling error where you've taken a sample that's not actually from within the nodule. Now, the risk of that is much, much lower with ultrasound guidance, and I think for most small nodules, ultrasound guidance for the biopsy is important. If the nodule is getting up to 2 or 3 centimetres, then it's still reasonable to just use palpation to guide the needle, but the yield from ultrasound-guided biopsies is superior. So the general recommendation after a benign biopsy is repeat the ultrasound in 6 to 18 months, and you get to choose how quickly, and you do that based on your overall assessment as to their risk. If the nodule then has not grown at all at that 6 to 18 month period, the latest guideline would say think about looking at it again in around 3 years, and if it's stable 3 years later, then forget about it. What does has not grown mean? Well, it tends to be a cutoff of 20% growth in two of the diameters, provided that the nodule is bigger than a centimetre to start off with, because, of course, even benign nodules will grow very slowly. So if on your scan 12 months later the nodule has grown by more than 20%, then that would be a criteria to consider a repeat biopsy.
So what about the patient who has a grown? I mean, there's no evidence of cancer and they're not thyrotoxic, but they do have a goiter that's causing symptoms. And what are the treatment options there?
Yeah, so you've got a range of treatment options that depend on the severity of the symptoms and also the patient's comorbidities. Thyroxine suppression, so giving a dose of thyroid medicine, even though the thyroid function is normal, has been used and it remains fairly popular in Europe, although less so in Australia. The theory here is that by giving thyroxine to reduce their TSH, you reduce the stimulus for further growth of those nodules, and trials have shown modest reductions in thyroid size in the vicinity of 20 to 40%. So I don't use that treatment very often. I reserve it for patients that have either only fairly mild symptoms or patients who are not keen to undergo surgery or indeed are not fit for surgery, where you may get a small benefit. The second thing would be iodine supplementation, and certainly while acknowledging that Australians now are only mildly iodine deficient, I do encourage my patients with with euthyroid goiters, whether or not they'd be nodular or not, to ensure they have an adequate iodine intake. What does that mean? It means I simply suggest when they add salt to their food, they use the green Saxa salt or the iodized salt rather than the non-iodized salt. And most people will get enough iodine with that simple measure rather than turning to a supplement. But the effects of both iodine and thyroxine are fairly modest. For more significant goiters, a treatment option is radioiodine ablation. The challenge here is that if the patient is not thyrotoxic, then the uptake that the thyroid has of the radioiodine is not always very good. If the patient's thyrotoxic, then the thyroid tends to take up that iodine, and therefore you can get really quite impressive reduction in either nodule size or even in diffuse goiter size in the vicinity of more like 30 to 50%. That reduction does take some time to come on, so around 6 to 12 months. But in people that are euthyroid or even in people with that are slightly hypothyroid, then the thyroid uptake is not always as good. And the consideration then becomes, well, what can I do to increase the uptake of that radioiodine treatment? There are centres elsewhere overseas that have used thyrogen for this purpose. Thyrogen is recombinant TSH. I'm not aware of anyone in Australia that's done this. One of the major barriers here is that the thyrogen wouldn't be paid for by the PBS, and therefore it would cost around $2,000 for that treatment, which is fairly price prohibitive. The other issue with radioiodine, of course, is that if you are able to get adequate uptake, then there is quite a high risk of developing hypothyroidism with time. Although, from an endocrinologist's perspective, we often think that's fairly easy to treat, although, of course, ideally, if you can be left with a functioning thyroid, would be a better situation. So for people with significant symptoms, the final and probably the best treatment option is often surgery. So if people are troubled by swallowing difficulties or breathing difficulties, certainly, then really surgery remains the gold standard for relief of these symptoms. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, in Australia, would that mainly be patients with multinodular goiter?
That's right. So multinodular goiter would be the number one reason for thyroidectomy in Australia still, rather than just a single solitary nodule. And certainly, you know, Graves, for example, where people have a diffuse goiter, surgery is only very rarely required because of the efficacy of the medical treatments and radioiodine. And sometimes if patients have a multinodular goiter that's predominantly affecting one lobe, then they can just have a hemithyroidectomy and they're still left with a functioning lobe which provides enough thyroid hormone. And the risks of surgery have become less and less, particularly with the advent of surgeons that specialise in endocrine surgery. And in terms of locations where you have access to an endocrine surgeon, then I'd certainly encourage use of endocrine surgeons rather than a jack-of-all-trade or a general surgeon, because I think that it doesn't really matter what operation you look at, complication rates tend to fall the more often the person do it, and the endocrine surgeons spend most of their days doing thyroid and parathyroid surgery, so their complication rates tend to be quite low.
Great. Thanks so much for chatting to us today on AFP Audio and for your excellent article in the August AFP.
Thank you. It was good to be here.